This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Since I was a teenager, I've admired the music of the Kinks, in part because the lead guitarist is also named Dave Davies, but even more because of the band's enduring rock anthems, written by its lead singer, Ray Davies. The Kinks haven't played together for years, but Ray Davies has just released his second solo album called Working Man's Cafe. Several of the songs mark a return to the social and political commentary Davies is known for. Here's the album's lead track, Vietnam Cowboys.
You better top up your suntan, otherwise your skin is gonna turn to leather. We made a movie in Vietnam. Tax break said we're gonna shoot on location. The rug says made in Korea, manufactured in a factory using cheap labor. And all over Asia, third world becoming a major league player. Mass production in Saigon, while all to workers laid off in Cleveland. Hot jacuzzi in Taiwan, with empty factories in Birmingham. Now it's baby boomers in Hong Kong and cowboys in Vietnam making their movies. Big confusion in Hollywood. Now it's American Major League in Japan, hamburger in China, with sushi bars in Maine and Boston. Dollar signs and expand. Now it's cowboys in Vietnam making their movies.
In the second half of today's show, we'll hear about Ray's solo career. But first, let's revisit the Kinks, who hit American charts as part of the British invasion of the 60s. Their early hits included such sexually driven songs as You Really Got Me, All Day and All of the Night, and Tired of Waiting for You, songs that influenced the new wave bands of the next generation. After those early records, Ray Davies started writing songs that were social satires of the time. Terry spoke to Davies in 1995, when his autobiography called X-Ray was released. Let's begin with the Kinks' 1966 single about the swinging London scene, Dedicated Follower of Fashion.
They seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town, eagerly pursuing all the latest fads and trends, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. Oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is,
oh yes he is.
Tell the story of how the band got the name of the
Kinks. Yeah, well, the Kinks were, we were in a pub after rehearsal, and Dave, my brother, and Pete, who was the bass player at the time, wore these capes and leather capes and high boots. And I guess for the early mid-60s, that was quite outrageous. And Kinky Boots, I think, was a single that the, it was a program called The Avengers had out. It was a TV show. And this guy standing at the bar sort of, you know, nonchalantly looking over, half drunk, looking at us and saying, "You blokes who call yourselves the Kinks because you look like them." I just didn't know quite what to say to this man. And then a man called Larry Page was standing with us, who became one of our managers. He said, "You know, you've got a point there. He's got the point, that guy. You should call yourselves the Kinks." The good thing about the Kinks is that it did leave an impression with people. Whether it was good or bad, it was a short, punchy, one-syllable word. And we were on the bottom of a bill with other artists. And our name was the smallest, so it had to be just a few letters. So it seemed to, you know, foot the bill or fit the bill. in every respect. And it was a name that really people remembered.
So did you have to visually play up the idea of Kinky?
I've always hated the name The Kinks. It's just, I think it's a daft name.
Mm-hmm.
And but I can't think of anything else to call us now except The Kinks. It's just, it's evolved. It's got our own meaning. Yes, it has kinkiness and whatever. But I think those connotations are not quite... I think The Kinks mean, in a true sense, maybe the edges or the wrinkles in society that maybe shouldn't be straightened out. And it's always opposed to walking the straight line always, because life isn't just a straight line.
Now, the first hit that you had was with your song, You Really Got Me. And you write in your book that this was considered too risky to record. What were the problems?
Well, it was, it wasn't, I suppose, wholesome enough to be, for the time, something that would be palatable for radio. And now it sounds really innocent and people say, well, what's wrong with the lyric? But for then, you've got to understand, it's a time when people still, although the Beatles were supposed to be a rough and ready outfit and the Rolling Stones were, there was still an element of polish about what everybody did. And the Kinks were a rough and ready outfit, there's no question about it. And so the record company eventually relented and let us record it and to get our character. And that record really epitomises a lot of the way we feel that the fuzzy, raw sound that Dave worked so hard to get is really the way the band sounded. And that's, I think, why it was a success.
Well, it's such a great record. Why don't we hear it? And this is The Kinks, You Really Got Me.
Not a lot, really. Not a lot.
How did the line come to you?
I'd written a song a few years. As I said, I tried to write instrumental phrases, and I'd been writing those a few years earlier. And there was this repetitive phrase, da 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 da, and going into strange accents and things. And I just probably sat there. We just had dinner at home. I went into the front room of the parlour where we had the piano, the little upright piano, and I started thumping this idea I'd thought of a few years earlier. And the words just came out. I think the subconscious was composing. It was not thought out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the trick. It just the words evolved with the notes and they match. And looking at the lyric, if I'd brought the lyric to somebody and said, write music to that, they'd probably tell me to get out, because it's not very, doesn't look very inspiring. It's like all these things, when you put the two pieces together, lyric and music, it adds up to something in a strange way.
Now, you said in your book that someone in your management said, well, I don't know whether you're singing to a boy or a girl, so you better put a girl's name in there somewhere.
That's right, yeah. Well, he was concerned about my, about what, who I was singing to and what my audience was. And I'm thankful in a sense that he suggested that I personalise it, because... although I didn't use a name at the end, I thought girl would be appropriate. And but just thinking about that change probably gave me the, I know it's not pretentious, but maybe it is, a psychological, and maybe my voice, the way I sang it sounded different. I sang the thing like I knew roughly where it was directed. And so although I didn't use Susan or Barbara or whatever, Barbara, You Really Got Me Going, I sang girl, and I had an image of somebody there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your book that you managed to keep the R&B feel even though making a pop record.
Mm.
And I think, yeah, that's really true. And also you write that you made a conscious effort to make your voice sound pure and to sing clearly, which I think is really interesting, considering that kind of really like fuzzy, aggressive guitar sound, and you're trying to sing, purely and clearly. It's a really interesting contrast.
Yeah, I think it's like the old line, no coward line, you know, remember the lines and speak clearly. We had Major Really Got Me once before, and we'd gone in with the producers and everything, and I'd been on tour, and my voice was a bit croaky, a bit like it is now, and you really got me going. It's like really down there. So and I remember that when we came to do the vocal, and we only had 3 hours to do it, so there was I, like, with 10 minutes to go, and it had to be right. So I thought, I took my voice up a bit, you know, and again, thought I was higher singing in a higher register than I was. And so emotionally, I was up there in the mid-frequencies, even though my voice was quite gravelly.
Yeah, because your voice got more pure and clear in later records, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. The diction kicked in, the diction factor.
Right, which was never a big thing in rock and roll.
No, but again, our agents, who did come from another era, it was that sort of transition from, I don't know, theatre, I guess. They always said, sing, I know it's blues, but you must be heard.
Let's play another song, another one that you wrote. Let's do Tired of Waiting for You, another early hit. Anything you can say about writing it?
That's from the original bunch I wrote, instrumentals, 2 years before. There is an interesting story because we just had this huge hit with You Really Got Me at number one, and we were doing our first album, and they said, we found a new writer, you know, it was me, and I was supposed to come up with all this material, but I didn't tell anybody. I didn't actually have anything except a few chords, and we went in and did the backtrack to that one morning, and they said, well, put the words, we used to put the vocal down at the same time, and I said, well, I've got a sore throat this morning, can I just do the backtrack first, the instruments first, and then I'll do the vocal later, because I hadn't written the lyrics, you know. And we did the backtrack, and afterwards I said, look, I really feel I'm coming down with something, flu or something. So I couldn't sing that day, and I went home and just, you know, went out that night and came in the next morning. I made the words up on the spot, really. And it is another one of those repetitive lyrics, but somehow it works, because even though I didn't think, again, I don't want to keep labouring the point, but I thought that I wasn't writing. I was taking in ideas, and although they weren't going down on notepads or, you know, written, they were inside my head. So it just came out. It's your life and you can do what you want. And basically I was telling myself, you know, I'm on this journey now, I've had this hit record, and it really is up to me what I write. So it was an interesting combination of being a bit of a con artist, telling them I had written something when I hadn't, and letting my emotions, my subconscious take over and do the work for me. It's very easy, really.
So you were fooling them, but you fooled them into thinking that you could do something that you actually found out you could do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, let's hear Tired of Waiting for You, the Kinks from the mid-60s. My guest is Ray Davies. Talking before about the guy who was brought in to help you improve the stage act, but at the same time, you say that the Kinks just stirred up an atmosphere of violence.
Yeah.
What was it about them? Was it something that happened on stage or off stage that you think was behind that?
I think inevitably the violence, the music, has a knock-on effect to what goes on off stage, and it's also to do with being, you know, very young doing this thing. I suppose we were the first or second generation of new musicians making a career out of rock music in England. And nobody taught us how to do it. And as I said, I was a student a few months earlier, living on a small grant subsidised by the government, you know, to go to college. My brother was at school, and Pete, the bass player, had just an ordinary little job. So we suddenly thrust into the spotlight, you know, on television all the time in the newspapers. And we couldn't go anywhere, you know, because literally it was like lots of screaming girl fans. And I think that if you put people, cage people up like that, I think inevitably they will, something will erupt into violence. And so all that put together ends up with quite a lot of friction.
Well, early on in the band's career, your brother Dave was dragged off the stage by fans and had a big bleeding cut on his head, I think. Did that scare you?
Well, it's what scared me even more. The cut was administered by the drummer.
Oh!
He hit him with a cymbal, which is a cymbal is quite a sharp instrument. But it was, again, from just being living together and this pent-up anger. I think both sides were equally to blame. I didn't actually see what happened, but I looked over and saw the drum kit fall to the ground and Dave on the floor with blood coming out of his skull, whatever. It was quite scary, and I thought the band was over then. They'd never get together again, but they did eventually, and it was still a success.
Now, what was it like for you when the band caught on in the States? Maybe you could tell us about your first American tour.
Our first American tour was an absolute catastrophe because we were unprepared for it. As I said, it was just after my wife had our first child, a daughter, Louisa. And I left the country, I think, when she was a week old. So we were living in this tiny bed. A bed city is like an apartment. It's got a bedroom, I suppose, and a little living room on the side. So I felt bad about leaving her. So we went on this tour. I was really emotionally unready. I was unprepared for it. And Dave and Mick had just gone through this incident where, you know, they'd had this fight on stage and David had these 9 stitches in his head and had the cymbal thrown at him. So it was a disaster waiting to happen, really. Or a tragedy waiting to happen, and we just didn't get along. It was just a series of really unlucky events, and eventually it culminated in a lawsuit so much as a ban by again, I don't really know, promoters or the union or whatever. It's just sometimes it's best to leave it alone, and they did, and we couldn't come back for 4 years.
Now, how did that affect you professionally?
Oh, I think we lost a lot of so-called revenue money from not doing tours. But I kept making records, and the records, I think, were hits here, and they did well here. But I think the sad thing was it was difficult for the audience here to keep up with us, because on our first tour here, we were still playing the heavy rock songs, like You Really Got Me. But the years I didn't tour here, I developed this sort of, I suppose, laid-back style, Sunny Afternoon, Well-Respected Man, all those songs, and Waterloo Sunset. And I suppose and not having videos to promote us, so they couldn't see us, it must have been difficult for our fans to actually keep up with what we were doing, because we could tour in England and everywhere else, but we only had the records here.
I mean, when you got back after the American tour, I guess that's about the time that your music changed from, you know, the more rock and roll oriented style to a more almost like social satire.
Yeah.
Songs about people living in the suburbs, songs that commented on, you know, the social mores of the time.
Yeah, well, I realized I was on this, as I said, a journey, this wonderful journey that started with You Really Got Me and Tired of Waiting. And now I could really get and write about people I knew about. Because You Really Got Me was about this frustrated, well, this tormented teenager, you know, who just wanted, I suppose it was a girlfriend for the sake of it, you know, just take a girl out after a dance, you know, go out together in the car, whatever. But now I could write about people I'd known when I was growing up and still, you know, I was still learning about people. So I found that really an interesting period to write about. Songs like Dedicated Follower of Fashion, songs like Autumn Almanac, which was really was about a man, a little hunchback man who used to live near me, who was a gardener, and he used to walk around the streets, and the kids used to be scared of him, and because, you know, he was an oddity. And I've always, in a sense, been drawn to people like that, odd people who are like on not outcast from society, but don't walk the straight line again. You know, the kinks of society, I guess.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we're listening back to Terry's interviews with Ray Davies, the lead singer and songwriter of the British invasion band The Kinks. He's just released his second solo album called Working Man's Cafe. Terry spoke to Ray Davies in 2006. He explained why his first solo album, Other People's Lives, came 10 years after The Kinks stopped playing together.
I didn't realize until I wasn't with the band how life-consuming it was, how much of my life was wrapped up in it. And me as a person, you know, you have to remember that I started this when I was just college. You know, I was barely formed as a human being and as a character. And I grew up in that band. And I had my life experience, in many respects, is limited to being in the band. So when I came to record this record, I had to find out who I was as an individual, because all the Kinks music was part of a machine, I know I wrote the songs, so I had an element of freedom, but everything had to be targeted. It was a Kinks, as you say, product. And although I don't like those sort of definitions as a rule, I was writing for a unit, a piece of machinery. And it wasn't until I left the band I did the Storyteller Tour, where I sang acoustically and anecdotes from my book, that I actually discovered there may be a me in there somewhere.
So you had to figure out who you were as a solo performer outside of the Kinks before you could write more songs?
Or where I was as a solo performer, or where, you know, what my range was. I've got, you know, people think of me as that tiny voice in all that power, all those power chords. Yeah, with my brother's great guitar and me trying to get my voice through. I think that's how people think of me. In fact, when people meet me, they're surprised that I'm quite tall. They expect a 5'2" guy because my voice was always squashed up between and compressed between the vocals and the guitars.
Now, the way I've read it, it sounds like you came to the United States as part of that process of writing new songs. You wanted to get away from the environment that you'd written in all along. So was that the reason for moving to the States for a while?
Well, Things Are Going to Change was written while I was still living in Surrey in England. It's a nice, very rural, there. And maybe I was saying to myself, things have got to change in my life. I've got to move on. You know, I don't know how a person can sit in one house all their lives and write lots of books, songs, and poetry. I needed to go on a journey, and that's what it felt like. It wasn't enough being not with the band. I needed to have an upheaval of some sort. You know, it's easy to say it now, but I didn't know it then. So I came to America, 2001, toured here. Just after 9/11, and I was writing songs and shooting my own video diary on the road.
So I know you spent a good deal of time in New Orleans. Did you move to New Orleans?
After the tour was over, I went back to New York, where I was based, and realized I needed to find, and this sounds very grand, but I wanted to find the source of the music that inspired me when I first started out. And the country that made me want to pick up the guitar was America. That, you know, it was American music. And all the people I was inspired by, from Hank Williams, country music, Big Bill Brunsey, who came from Chicago, but I think was actually born in Mississippi, all somehow had a connection with the South. And, you know, I liked Dixieland as a kid. You know, we had a lot of that music in the house. And I went to the Highgate Jazz Club, where I grew up, and saw Dixieland. So I wanted to go there and see it. And I went for some personal reasons. I went on a personal visit as well. But I grew attracted to the place. And I looked, initially, I stayed in B&Bs, you know, for a few weeks, looking for somewhere to rent and looking for somewhere to buy at the end.
Let's hear one of the songs that I think relates in some way to New Orleans. It's called The Getaway. And it starts with a line about, you know, lonesome train. And that's such an American blues kind of thing. Mm. I don't know. There's a lot of trains in England. I don't know that you'd associate them with, like, the lonesome train.
Absolutely. Well, that song, The Getaway, in parentheses, Lonesome Train, was written on my first visit to New Orleans. The first time I was down there, I wrote that song all in one pass. It was a first draft. That was, and I didn't feel... I'm very coy about using phrases and terms that have been used by other people. I love blues music, but I never attempt to be a blues man.
Mm.
And Lonesome Trains, yeah, the lonesome whistles and all that from the classic Hank Williams songs and the blues men, as you said. But I was there, and I actually, every morning I'd hear that train coming in, and it woke me every morning, and I loved hearing it. It was like a friend. And when it reminded me of where I grew up in North London. I lived very close to a train track. And it was a comfort zone for me to be there.
Well, let's hear The Getaway, and this is from Ray Davies' album, which is called Other People's Lives. That's The Getaway from Ray Davies' CD, which is called Other People's Lives, and it's his first solo CD. I really like the song a lot, and to me it's a song about, you know, somebody who makes their getaway from a relationship or from a neighborhood or a home or maybe even from life itself. Mm. Somebody who's just, you know, made the final exit intentionally.
Yeah.
I don't know if you feel that way, but as a listener, it seems to me it's speaking on all those levels.
That's precisely the level I was, or the levels I was writing about. You know, you don't. The secret is, though, not to know it when you're writing it.
Uh huh.
Just to feel and do all the analysis later on. I don't intellectualize what I write, because I think my instinct is smarter than my actual being. And there's a long fade out in that song, and there's a reason for that. It goes on and on and on. And if you just think about it, it's like there's a punchline and a deep voice comes up at the end, it's like whispering in my ears, the singer's ear, saying, yeah, man, it's time to get out the door. It's time to make that move. You've been saying it all your life. Do it. You know, make the move or you're going to get the lonesome train. So the lonesome train is isolation.
So I want to play another song.
That's what we're here for.
From the CD.
Yeah.
And this one's called Run Away From Time.
Yeah.
I think it's a great song, and I think, yeah.
I wrote it for somebody else. I forget who it was.
You wrote it for somebody else?
Yeah. You know what it really is? The subtext to this, I think, is you can't run away from your back catalogue. Think of that.
That's a very existential thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
Run away from your own hits.
Yeah, you can't remember. It's difficult, you know, it's always been a problem. It's wonderful having a back catalogue. But coming to do new music, people always want to hear the hits.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, you know, when I hear Run Away From Time, I don't think of it as a song about getting away from your catalogue of songs, obviously. I think of it as being about, you know, trying to run away from aging. And, of course, you can't really, but but you try.
Oh, no, but that's an element of it, and that's the obvious starting point.
And that's why I like this.
I never write things that are that easy.
Right, and there's this, like, run away chorus, and, of course, this isn't about, like, the kind of physical running, and so it really works.
No. I think there's an element of that, being of a certain age on this record, which I'm absolutely proud to be, and I think it's something that should be... I think we've gone through a terrible phase of ageism in world and in media, but I think, you know, when I was 16 years old, I was buying tickets to see Sonny Boy Williamson play when I was a student. I think smart kids always look for good music that would interest them, and it's not always dictated by the charts or what they see on television.
Well, let's hear Runaway From Time, and this is from Ray Davies' CD, Other People's Lives.
Hey, my friend, you can't run away from time. They say you can't fight fate, time won't wait. You can't run away from time.
This is a pretty horrible story. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, have already heard it. But while you were living in New Orleans...
Well, it was when I'd moved out to start... I came back to England at the end of 2003 to finish the recording. All the songs on this album were written prior to 2004 and recorded. And I went over to New Orleans. We were going to have a holiday there, New Year's, spend New Year's. We had a good New Year's Eve there. And about the 4th of January 2004, I got attacked and shot, yeah. It was quite harrowing.
Would you describe what happened?
Well, just walking around the street, walked around. I used to go jogging a lot at night on my bicycle. I love cycling in New Orleans. And this was a sunny afternoon, late in the afternoon. And guy came up with a gun, attacked us, and stole my girlfriend's bag. And I ran after him. I just had a bad day, I think. And this was just the topper. I didn't really want to deal with anything, but I just felt... you just never know until it happens to you, I suppose, how a person reacts.
Well, that's the thing. Did you decide to chase after this guy with a gun, or did you just reflexively do it without even thinking?
Well, the irony is that, you know, near the end of this record took a long time to make.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really losing my temper with myself and everybody around. I was irritable, not nice to be around because I hadn't finished my work. And that was left in England. But after that, we'd been to a restaurant, and I just decided to be a calmer, better, easygoing person. And actually, I don't mind if I don't finish this record or I don't mix this record. I'm going to relax here, maybe buy a place here and live in New Orleans. And walk out and get shot. And in a sense, I was put into hospital, and my injuries were quite more severe or serious than people realized. But it gave me the incentive to get back and come to terms with finishing my record and getting it done. That was my quest. after that.
So it sounds like you were in a real grouchy mood before you were shot. You were going to shelve the whole record?
Yeah, I was on the verge of just stopping doing. I said, this is taken. I started principal recording in January 2002, and it was the end of 2003. And it's a long time to finish a record, and I actually felt I was in the frame of mind I didn't want to finish it.
So when your girlfriend's purse got nabbed by this guy or guy with a gun, did you just reflexively run after him, or did you make a conscious decision?
It's a question I'll always ask myself, and I'm still trying to work that out.
You're not sure?
Not sure. I just didn't feel it was right to be treated that way. And what... this is so difficult to talk about, but he was really scared. And he's the one that had the gun. I got a close look at him, and he was really scared. And I just felt it was not right to let him get away with it. And I didn't know there was a car waiting and a driver. And he stopped. I nearly caught him, and he stopped at the car and just turned around and shot me.
If you don't mind my asking, was there a moment where you saw the shooter looking at you and taking aim, and you knew was there a moment you knew you were going to get shot?
Yeah, it was a classic. You know how they train people to shoot guns. You know that position, that crouch position.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just ran, dived, like they do in the movies. And I try not to think about it, because there are only fragments. You know, it's like writing songs. It's a line, one-liners. It's not a constant memory, a constant replay.
So I mean, like, even when you think about it, you only have fragments of that memory. There isn't one complete connected narrative that you have.
Yeah, it's just like songwriting.
Would you ever write a song about this?
I already had at that time. The song was called "I, the Victim," and that's the most harrowing part of this whole process. It was the recovery process that was the most difficult, because I had to go back to my music. And there's a song on the album called "After the Fall." There's a song on the album about tourists, take the money, you know, attack the tourists, whatever. And I'd written the song "I, the Victim," which was almost the incident played out. And I don't know if I'll go back to that. It may come out on another record, but it's...
Would you recite or talk a few of the lines?
I didn't write a song called "You Really Shot Me." I don't recommend it for any aspiring songwriters if they're looking for source material.
Ray Davies, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, as always.
Ray Davies of The Kinks speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. His new solo album is called Working Man's Cafe. Philippa Gregory is a British academic who's used her background in history to write romantic historical novels, many set in the Tudor period. In 2002, her first Tudor novel, The Other Boleyn Girl, became a bestseller and was subsequently adapted for BBC television. Now it's a movie starring Scarlett Johansson and Natalie Portman. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Anne Boleyn is the subject of countless books, plays, movies, and ballads, and well, she should be. She wasn't just a party to the end of a royal marriage, but to the beginning of a religious denomination, a shift that triggered one of Britain's bloodiest schisms. She's been portrayed as a shrewd hussy, a thoughtful heroine, and now, in The Other Boleyn Girl, a bit of both. But in the end, the Anne of Natalie Portman is a feminist victim, not an innocent, but still a pawn of arrogant and overweening males, her power illusory. Her final solace, the loyalty of her enduring sister, Mary, played by the movie's other American it girl, Scarlett Johansson. The Other Boleyn Girl has a novel take that the ambitious Boleyn patriarchs pimped out these sisters for the sake of power and prestige. And I know that phrase got MSNBC news commentator David Schuster suspended a few weeks back, but I'm not talking about the same family. And by the way, Schuster was lucky. If it had been England under Henry VIII, he'd have been suspended from a gallows. At the instigation of her covetous uncle and father, Anne comes close to bewitching King Henry, played by Eric Bana, but makes the mistake of looking more proficient on a horse than he does. So it's Mary, a dewy newlywed, who becomes his mistress, while Anne, livid with jealousy, hatches a plot to flash her dark eyes at the monarch and then refuses him, driving him into a libidinous frenzy. Directed by Justin Chadwick, from a script by Peter Morgan, who wrote The Queen, The Other Boleyn Girl is, historically speaking, balderdash. It has the feel of a game of telephone, in which, from whisperer to whisperer, information is progressively mangled. The Boleyn sisters, who in life weren't close, are in Philippa Gregory's best-selling period romance, both subtle rivals and intimate co-conspirators. Morgan transforms them into total opposites. The famously promiscuous Mary, now a goody-good country girl with a demeanor that's vaguely Amish. The thoughtful Anne, now a Scarlett O'Hara type in brilliant green. Their conflict goes from a simmer to a boil as Anne, now the green apple of the king's eye, visits her sister, bedridden with a precarious pregnancy.
Anne. I meant to come sooner. I'm sorry I did not. I've been kept occupied.
So I hear. Amusing the king.
Only that, sister, I assure you. Despite his best efforts.
What, not yours?
How is it?
The child is strong. He gives me no rest. Like his father.
Do you feel as awful as you look? You know, in France, no woman would allow herself to get in such a state.
Why did you come, Anne, if all you desire is to torment me?
Perhaps now you know how it feels. To be deceived by your sister.
I did nothing.
You stole the king away, and then you betrayed me over Henry Percy.
If that's what you think, fine, tell yourself that.
I did, sister. Every day and every night I was in exile.
As soap opera, The Other Boleyn Girl offers none of the kinky pleasures of Showtime's The Tudors, in which Jonathan Rhys-Meyers emits the kind of twisted pansexual vibe that could conceivably upend an empire. Eric Bana's Henry is a relative cipher, and the movie is all on the surface. But the pace is brisk, the lines have snap, and the feminist revisionism does have weight. And what of these young American actresses putting on British accents to vie for the king? They seem at first like co-eds in a college production of The Importance of Being Earnest. But once our dislocation fades, their Yankee gumption wins us over. For starters, they're so gorgeous they're worthy of oil paintings. When Henry studies Anne at prayer, the downy hairs on the back of her neck have a glow that's first angelic and then devilishly alluring. Portman gives the other Boleyn girl what it needs, a drama queen who grows on the scaffold into a real queen. Even more surprising, Scarlett Johansson pulls off Mary, a role that's a muddle of innocence and opportunism and dopey passivity, a potential career killer. But with no evident strain, with almost everything internalized, Johansson makes sense of her character's contradictions. She keeps her head, and makes you understand why Mary kept hers.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Finally, this just in from Springfield. Our very own Terry Gross will make her animated debut with Homer, Marge, Bart, and Lisa on the next episode of The Simpsons, appearing as a special guest voice. That's Sunday on The Simpsons on Fox.